Good morning and welcome to In Focus on News Radio KMAN. Today we are joined by Dr. Steve Short, who works at Inspire ENT and Pulmonology here in Manhattan and recently volunteered on the front lines where COVID-19 has been rampant in New York City. Dr. Short, thank you for the time today to share your story.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, how you ended up going to New York City in the first place and why you decided to volunteer.
Well, I'm a member of the American College of Chest Physicians. Yeah, there's a journal they have called Chest that they send emails out, and there was an urgent email that said there was a crisis in New York, and they were asking for volunteers. And I was in a mood, I guess, to say I needed to do something to help. So I put my name in the hat. Then I told my wife and told my children, which I'm upset about. But I think they all understood my heart, and that's kind of what drives me, is to do things like this. So that's basically what got me there. They assigned me to a public hospital called Woodhull. And, I wasn't sure what I was getting into. I committed 5 days. I felt like I wasn't sure how much time I really needed to be there or how much they needed me to help. But once I got there, I found out I was the only pulmonary critical care specialist, and they had converted the whole hospital to COVID. They were desperate for help. I was surprised that there wasn't more help there than there was. And I committed to more time to help out.
As far as the size of the hospital, give us an idea of how big this is of a hospital.
Oh, it's in the middle of Brooklyn. It's in somewhat of an impoverished area. It's a hospital built initially for acute care, but also I think a strong emphasis of drug and alcohol rehab. So there's 2 or 3 floors that are just for that purpose. And it's part of the New York Hospital Association's public system. So there's 11 hospitals in that, and it's one of those. It's it was pretty much right in the heart of the worst part of COVID. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know where this place was, and the concept of the hospital system in New York, but the hospital in a matter of 2 weeks had gone from basically normal 300-bed facility with one ICU with 10 beds to a 400-bed facility with 9 ICUs. Every floor was an ICU. They assigned me to the 3-PACU, which is the originally post-anesthesia recovery. And it ended up that being, I was the main pulmonary critical care doctor. I was taking care of the sickest of the sick, and had a crew of doctors, one neurosurgeon trained in London, who was my absolute best friend in this whole journey, and he was a strong ally with his training, especially because COVID affects the brain in such a bizarre way. And then a crew of nurses and other staff that was all volunteer from all over the country. There wasn't one person in that unit that was originally from that part. It was kind of an interesting mix of different people that all had a heart, for what was going on.
You mentioned not knowing what you were getting into, and obviously New York's been one of the, if not the worst spot, at least here in the United States, for COVID. Take us behind the scenes, if you would, about what you saw and just how dire was the situation.
Well, besides the fact that everybody was on a ventilator, and they'd been on a ventilator for a couple of weeks, and really there wasn't any chance that they were probably going to get off the ventilator. There was a crew of guys I started with. A couple of them started nights. And first morning we met after a night shift. They said it was just constant code blue. People were dying just left and right. And through my time there, there was not a day that went by that there was just not a constant overhead PA system announcing Code Blue, and that basically meant someone was dying. So the hardest part was seeing how many people died and how many people died without any way to make it different. You really had nothing you could offer them other than just life support, because there really aren't any medicines out there. Just the most bizarre disease. I mean, it just devastates the body. And in ways, I don't think you can train, or I hadn't ever trained, and I don't think anybody who came through had an eye for before just how devastating it was to the brain, the kidneys, the lung, the heart. I think it boiled down to really a very strong inflammatory pro-coagulating process, meaning that the blood coagulated. And you know, in medical terms, it's called a D-dimer, a kind of a marker of coagulation. And there were D-dimer markers that are over 100,000 just routinely. And, you know, it was like a life awakening reality to see how sick people were and how I was pretty much in the midst of being in charge of the ventilators and the sickness for the time I was there. I don't think I've ever worked that hard in my life. They really, I think, wanted us to be there, and I didn't ever understand why it was the only pulmonary critical care that showed up, but I did find out that being a public hospital, they really didn't have that kind of staff there, and there wasn't anybody else volunteering to do it. They had hired some locums to come while I was there, and then when I left, that's one of the reasons I left. They had a whole crew of locums that were critical care doctors coming that I didn't see a need to stay if there were these people staying, and they're being hired for a month to 2 month stays. But my time, I think I was really the time they asked me to be involved was when they needed their residents to take a break, because those residents had been pretty much the doctors on 24/7 since it started. So literally the day after I got there, they let their residents off, and then my crew took over, and that meant none of us had trained with the medical record called Epic. None of us knew the system. We had a crew of people that didn't know the system, but it's amazing how quickly you learn the system. And I felt compelled to be there to cover the shift till evenings came. So there's only two shifts a day. So I started at 7, and I'd literally get off at 9 every day. The last 4 hours of the day, I let the crew, my medical crew, go, and I stayed and just covered the bases. And in those 4 hours, I always called it the witching hour, because right after they left the door, things just started to happen bad. And so I was working really hard, really exhausted. And, I was appreciated. I mean, it was obvious that what we did helped, and it was a huge relief for them to be able to take a break. When I did have residents, it was a really strong teaching environment. I was able to, you know, give them the education that they needed. And, you know, when they said, you know, we're having these other guys come, would you mind taking, because you're such a good educator, would you mind taking over our medical education? Because our residents really haven't, had any formal training in this time frame. And I committed initially, but then after I did, I said, you know, this seems to be a luxury more than anything, and I have to quarantine when I get home for 2 weeks, and that's what I'm in the middle of doing right now. And I'm not sure I really can afford to leave my practice this long for this purpose. I mean, what I had done initially was really to kind of take over and help, and I think I did, and I think I did it, you know, covered a big hole that they needed. But that hole got filled fairly quickly, and I really felt there was a comfort level for me to maybe bow out and say, I'm going to go back and take care of my people at home.
Goodness. Well, so how long did you end up staying then? Was it 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah.
Okay. Well, obviously, working that hard, not just you, but everybody.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that that can really take an emotional toll on you, I'd imagine. How do you cope with something like that?
Well, I think when you're in the midst of it, it just is what you do. And as you're aware, I wrote at least 3 times a day on Facebook, just kind of my memoir. I told my wife I was going to journal this whole trip, and I ended up journaling it on Facebook and ended up getting tons of followers. I had no comprehension of that coming about. But, so for me, it was a good way to release my emotions I was going through, you know, just to see the death every day, so many people dying. And more importantly, in my mind, it was dealing with the families, but that hadn't happened yet. I felt a real need to emotionally pray as well as be with them and, you know, talk to them on the phone. They really couldn't be in the hospital. We've got a palliative care team going that helped, you know, making sure people are being called and being notified about their families. So part of my energy comes from, you know, that interaction with family, that interaction with the staff. Initially, when I started praying, I think it was obvious that it was meaningful and it was seen as a real value, but also kind of opened some doors. As I prayed more with different people and different families, that we let one person come in at a time to see dying families. I would always pray with them. And then I remember I told my wife the last time I prayed with one of my special patients, literally the whole unit came over. Mm. And there were like 30 people around the bed. And it's such a solemn moment. And, you know, for me, that's, I guess the real meaning is what I do has always been spiritual and as well as healing. And then, as you know, or as you probably know, I draw, so I was drawing all day, drawing staff, drawing issues, sharing that, giving that art away. I come home and draw. That just for me, when I get stressed in life, drawing ends up becoming my ally and writing. And so I guess to answer your question in the long run, what got me through it was my writing, my drawing, and my art. So I'm still doing it. I'm coming home. This has been hard to get away from that because you just saw so much, and I'm still finding the need to express.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the artwork's beautiful. I've seen quite a bit of it here just looking the last few days online. And now you're back home. You're in quarantine yourself, correct?
Yeah. And we have an Airbnb on Thackeray that we fixed up, and it's really nice, and eventually someday we actually may live in it, but it's not been rented with Airbnb, you know, and so I initially was going to our house in Colorado, but Colorado had a quarantine, so if I'd gone there, I'd have to come home and quarantine again. It just didn't make any sense, so I'm starting my second week of quarantine now, and, I start seeing patients, and, you know, that'll get back into the... you know, the kind of the familiar tone of being a doctor again here in Manhattan.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, obviously you were in one of the worst hit places in the world. And it seems like there's a sense out here that we're protected from this virus. What would you tell people who say that?
Well, you know, when I made my initial rounds with residents, I asked them all, like, what happened? How'd this start? And they said, you know, end of February, 1st of March, there wasn't anything. And then one day, there was a case that came in the ER. They didn't know what it was. There wasn't any testing. They couldn't do anything about it. They let the patient go. They wouldn't even give them. That patient, went in the community. And then the next day, there was 20 patients. And then, like, in a matter of just 2 or 3 days, it exploded. And so, you know, then it was out of control. I mean, it was everybody dying and not enough ventilators, not enough PPE, not enough, you know, not enough drugs, not enough IV tubing, not enough, you know, things that we give drugs with that they didn't have. They were reusing catheters. I mean, it was crazy stuff. So I guess what I'd say is if it gets in, it can blow up, and we have to do everything we can to prevent it from getting in. I think we have to have good testing, and we have to have good, you know, public health control, identify cases when they initially happen, and, you know, trace them, get them contained. It's simple public health, you know, dialogue that just needs to be part of who we are. I trained at the CDC, and part of my job was investigation, and I went out and investigated what we call health hazard evaluation. And it was just this simple concept of being on top of it when it happens and preventing it from happening again. So I think we've done a good job. I came home. I saw people still quarantining, distancing. I mean, I really am proud of our community. One of our congressmen called me when I was in New York and said, I need your help in Southwest Kansas. We've got an explosion in the meatpacking plants. And I had a sleep lab down there, and I called the sleep director, and I said, what's going on? And he said, well, you know, the PPE and the, you know, protection in the company has been good, but these people go out afterwards and they socialize and they have the, you know, culture that says we're going to be together, and they end up going home, and lo and behold, it blew up. And luckily, and hopefully that's contained down there, but that's exactly how it happens. It just, it gets out, and it's like dominoes, just they all fall.
Yeah. It's been tough. I know the last few months, no one's enjoying this at all. It's just been tough on everybody. But is there anything else? I'm out of questions. Is there anything else you wanted to share with us?
I think the issue, I guess I would raise the issue of isolation. I think we've all been isolated. And, you know, these families in the hospital are isolated. Their loved ones are isolated. But we all have been isolated. Before I left, you know, it was hard for me to leave because I wasn't sure if I'd get it, not come home. And my family was the same way. And before I left, I went by all my kids, my grandkids, houses in Kansas City, and I said, I just want to see it one time before I leave. And in doing so, they stood in the driveway. I stood on the other side of the driveway, and we said our goodbyes. And the isolation of life has become just so hard. And I just pray that we all have love, that we can get back together and give each other hugs and know that it's all been worth it. So I pray for our society, not just these people I took care of, but anybody who's been in this has suffered in their own way. And it's sad to see, but I'm proud of everyone to go through it, and hopefully we'll all be better as a result. So yeah. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you so much. We sure appreciate the story here, and we're glad that we can get a chance to tell it.